Recording has started.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the Review of All Rights Protection Mechanisms, RPM, and All GTLDs PDP Working Group Call held on the 14th of February, 2018. In the interest of time, there'll be no roll calls. We have quite a few participants. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you are only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourself be known now? We already have Brian Beckham noted on audio only. Anyone else?
This is Claudio.
Thank you, Claudio. Noted. Hearing no further names, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for transcription purpose, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it back over to our co-chair, J. Scott Evans. Please begin.
Thank you very much. This is J. Scott Evans for the record. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everyone. Our first agenda item, as you can see in the top right-hand pod or window that is in the Adobe Connect room, is to review the agenda. But first, I'd like to ask if there are any updates to any statements of interest. Okay, hearing none, we have one agenda item today, and that is hopefully to go through the URS topics document, the high-level questions that we've identified that we're going to attempt to answer, and while going through that, to identify what types of data we may need in order to assist us in answering the questions that we've identified for answering. So, I'm trying to see. This has been unlocked, so if you will note that the document is unsynced and you may move it yourself with your own machine. You don't need staff to do it for you. So you see here we have part one. We've got, I'm sorry, everybody. There we go. Well. Okay, so we see here that we have this document. Part one lists the suggested review topics. We start as was suggested during our earlier calls, that we sort of follow the process through in a logical fashion. So we start with the complaint. And under the complaint, the things that we've decided we need to consider are the standing to file, the grounds for the complaint, the filing period, administrative review, the notice of complaint, and those, receipt by the registrant, effect on the registry operator. Those are the topics we feel like that we need to explore under the broader topic of the complaint. Now, looking at that, the question to the group is there any suggested data that you all suggest that we need to look at in order to help us evaluate these particular points? Yes, I see Barry Cobbs raised his hand.
Thank you, J. Scott. Barry Cobb for the record. For Section A, the complaint itself and understanding about the standing grounds for filing, limited filing period, and administrative review, and Section B that you mentioned, the notice itself, I think for the most part, if there are data suggestions from the working group, that predominantly any data source for that will likely be from the providers themselves. With the data that we've acquired thus far from scraping the URS cases from the provider sites, essentially if a case was filed and ends up on the provider site, obviously it met the criteria for standing to file. Otherwise, in the administrative review, it probably would have been declined. But in general, any of that information would likely be coming from the providers, and I don't see a way where staff can provide any data in that regard. I would note that for the notice and receipt by the registrant, this is likely something also possibly, I can't speak for the providers, but just trying to think out loud here, is when the complaint is filed or and after the administrative review is done, hypothetically, there would at least be a copy of that notice that was sent to the registrant and perhaps any SMTP logs that would show that the email did in fact go out or if there were any undeliverable notices and those kinds of things. I'm not sure if they retain those records or those logs. And I know that there has been discussion with regards to whether the registrant actually did in fact receive the notice or not. You know, I don't think we'll ever get to a true complete picture of understanding that from end to end, but it could be something for this group to deliberate on a little bit further as to, you know, a future possible recommendation, for instance, that maybe there is more robust logging on the notice being sent to the registrant. Thank you.
Thanks, Barry. So, as you've seen from Barry's comments, he doesn't believe that staff can pull together a lot of this information. So the question is, what data do we need and where do we get it? Barry seems to indicate that we would need to start with the providers and ask them some questions. So, I mean, just throwing it out there, I could see one possible question is, you know, since the inception of the URS, how many complaints have you received from respondents claiming they haven't received the complaint? I mean, that seems to me a quantifiable question that would let us know something. But I'm open to others giving some ideas of what they think. Do we need to, since some, I'm sure the providers will be involved, we want to make a list of questions that we would provide, we would send to the providers. I'm open to anyone providing here their thoughts on what kind of data they think we need to obtain and where they think we can obtain it from. And if you have a suggestion of the type of question or type of solicitation we would make to the person or entity holding the data, what that would be. Does no one have any thoughts or comments on the complaint and that charge? I see Kathy's raised her hand.
Can you hear me?
You're very, very faint, but I do hear you.
Okay. If there's any way, Julie,
now we've lost you, Kathy. If you want to write your stuff into the chat, I'm happy to read it to the group.
Okay, I'll dial back in. Thanks.
Okay. With that, I'm going to turn to Zach.
Sure. Thank you very much. Zach Muskovich for the record. So just two things I want to mention about the complaint heading. So first, with regards to the service or notification of the complaint, you'd asked whether there were any suggestions about data that can be collected. And as I mentioned in the chat, perhaps one simple data point is whether the providers received any bounce back from the notification emails. Also, under the complaint heading aspect, I wonder if any data can be collected as to what extent the complainants relied and submitted upon the TMCH SMD files to demonstrate use of the mark, and whether the panelists recognized that as proof of use and acknowledged it. And this is further to the email to the group that Kathy Kleinman, just before this call commenced, circulated with a case study of certain concerns about the panelists' appreciation of the role that the TMCH plays in these proceedings. Thank you.
Okay. Susan Payne? Susan, I think you may be on mute.
Hi, yes.
There you are.
Sorry, it takes a while to get off mute. There's too many things to press. I wondered if someone could expand on that comment that Zach just made. I mean, for For those of us who haven't had the benefit of reading an email from Kathy in the last, I don't know how many minutes, I'm not sure what the point is that's being made here and why it's being suggested that we need to establish whether the TMCH data was being used or not. So that would be very helpful. In terms of data points, I thought we were dealing with A, the complaint first, but a lot of people seem to be sort of dealing with A and B together. So on that basis, in relation to B, it seems to me that we could usefully look at, in addition to the complaints that you mentioned, J. Scott, about how many complaints providers had received that they hadn't received the complaint. We could also look at appeals, you know, how many appeals were filed where lack of receipt of the complaint was being cited as the reason why someone, you know, hadn't responded.
All right. Thank you very much, Susan. I see now Zach's hand. Is that an old hand, or did you re-raise your hand, Zach?
New hand. Just in further to Susan's question, which is well taken, and I about the my comment previously about the TMCH. So this is news to me as well, and I only briefly read the email before the call. But it seems to me from a glance at it that in at least this one particular case that was identified, the examiner received as part of the complaint package from the complainant a .smd file, which is tended as proof of use of the mark, and that's from the TMCH. And so even though the panelist was provided with this proof of use, the panelist still stated in the decision apparently that no use was proven. And so that shows that there's a misunderstanding, at least on a part of this particular panel, as to the role of the SMD files, and which relates to another question that was raised in the email sent to the group prior to the call, and how these files are opened and to what degree the panelists are aware of the role that these files play and demonstrate in demonstrating use in these complaints. So it to look at that data point would require some look at the decisions themselves, because it's apparent from at least a brief review of this particular one that there was a misapprehension of the procedure and the approach to proving use. Thank you.
Thank you, Zach. I'm going to call on Barry.
Thank you, J. Scott. Just to respond to what's being discussed here, and I think as Lori Shulman had pointed out in the chat, you know, the SMD file is strictly just a proof of use item in terms of registering a name with a registry during the sunrise period. And I unfortunately didn't get to review Kathy's email, so I'm flying blind a little bit about the particulars of that particular of case. I would just note that I have, in reviewing a few cases, it has been mentioned in the examiner documentation, or at least the documentation provided by the complainant, that their particular mark was loaded into the trademark clearinghouse. And I'd note that was kind of, I believe, in Rebecca's research, that is a planned code or an element that they intend to look at, that if it is mentioned in a particular URS case, that, you know, they'll flag that as it being denoted there. The last thing I'll say, just from a TMCH perspective, is when the working group circles back to the trademark clearinghouse work that has been put to the side while we're doing the URS case review, we are working with IBM to be able to get data from actual claims notices, and then we'll be able to, you know, map that to the URS cases that we see today. So as a brief example, let's say there were 100 notices sent out of the 827 URS cases. We'll be able to reconcile those actuals of data up to the end of 2017. Thank you.
Thanks very, very much. Okay, before we get too far off the rails here and start digging down into one particular issue with regards to one particular case, I mean, I think I want to keep this at a higher level and decide, you know, when we look at when we're looking at the things listed under A and B, what data do we think we need to answer and to look into these questions? And so far, it looks like what I've heard so far with regards to at least those under B, that looks like we're going to have to reach out to at least the service provider and maybe the registry operators to get some information from them with regards to those two. That's what I see. And it looks like that's what I think is good data for them. We would need to submit questions to them and ask specific questions. With regards to A, I think I still haven't heard anyone give me any specific data points or data groups or repositories of data or holders of data or people we could reach out to get this answered. Now, in our chair call the other day, Phil Corin mentioned that there may be questions here that aren't necessarily tied to data. They're more policy oriented, and that is, should we change things? And that's not necessarily something that would be driven by any particular data. It's just a policy decision is based on what the compromises that were made in the URS as it exists and has been. Do we see anything that, from a policy perspective, requires changing? That may not need data to answer those questions. So sort of with that guidance of let's keep it high, let's not drill too far down into the weeds, I'm going to go to John McGowan, and then I'm going to go to Kathy Kleinman. John?
Well, Jay Scott, I'm afraid that I'm getting into the weeds, but I just wanted to highlight that what has been put in the chat is correct, that a SMD file is a .txt file. It lists the mark that was registered at the Trademark Clearinghouse and then a very lengthy set of numbers and letters. And to your point, exactly, just looking at one case and somebody that improperly labeled an SMD file a .smd, we shouldn't go chasing all these rabbits. So anyways, thank you for letting me put that comment in.
Yeah. Okay, Kathy?
Hi, Kathy Kleinman. Can you hear me now? I'm on a different phone.
Much better.
Okay, good. So hey, I think the high-level question here is the proof of use sufficient in what's being provided? We are getting complaints. I've gotten some that say that the SMD file is difficult to open or impossible to open by the examiner and by the registrant. We've also heard differently from someone, but I got it from John Berryhill, who came to us as part of the educational session, the URS. So that's a question worth noting. Is the proof of use? Is the SMD file readable? Another thing in the URS, and this is high level as well, is that the requirement in the URS in 1.2.5 in the complaint is that the specific trademark and service marks upon which the complaint is based and pursuant to which the complaining parties are asserting their rights for which goods in connection with what services has to be provided. And the SMD file doesn't do that, particularly in the case of figurative mark design marks. And so, you know, is it? So it seems like a very valid high-level question, which is the proof of use sufficient for the examiner and for the registrant? And where we go to get that data is probably looking into the cases themselves or talking with maybe bringing Doug and John back as expert URS counsel and talking to other complainants and respondents in this proceeding. But it's a really important question. Is proof of use sufficient? Thank you.
I'll call on Susan Payne.
Sorry, thanks. Just a really quick comment. I'm not sure who the expert counsel is that we would are supposed to be encouraging to come back. It seems to me that we've got any number of people who are quite familiar with the URS in this working group. I mean, there are hundreds of people who've volunteered to join this working group. I'm not sure that we need to elevate someone who hasn't joined this working group to the status of an expert. I'm also, to be honest, I'm not really sure that we need to necessarily look at cases on this topic. It seems to me if there's a question about the proof of use, maybe the first place to start would be we talk to the providers. It's come up on a number of calls, and we've said a number of times it would be really good for us to take advantage of the fact that we do have representatives from the providers, and there's an awful lot of information that they undoubtedly could give us to stop us going down rabbit holes that we don't need to go down. So I think the idea of collecting a list of questions to ask the providers would be a really good one, and that would be probably a very useful first step for us. And we can then ask them about things like, what proof of use they get and whether they're, whether it's good enough, at least initially, before we start thinking about opening up hundreds of cases. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I see Rebecca Tushnet's hand has come up.
Thank you, Rebecca Tushnet, for the record. So I actually think asking providers of these questions is a really good idea. So let me weigh in support of that. But I have to say, I'm not quite sure what we think the providers will be doing that's other than like reporting to us what they think they see in the cases, right? So it is case review. It's just we don't get to see their underlying data. That doesn't mean it's not relevant, but I don't think saying let's not do case review, let's ask the providers what they're seeing is actually a substitute. Thank you.
Thank you. I see we have Martin. Susan, is that an old hand or a new hand? Old hand. Martin? I'm afraid, Martin, you appear to be on mute. I am not hearing Martin. Is anyone else hearing him, or is he? Is anyone else there? Are you hearing me?
Hi, Jay Scott. It's Terry. So Martin is now unmuted. Martin, if you could please check the mute on your side.
Okay, Martin, if you could raise your hand. I mean, I'm sorry, place your comments in the chat. Perhaps I can read them to the group. I see you've stated in the chat you're not sure why it's not working, and you've said that you will put your comments in the chat, and I will read them to the group once they've come in. Okay, so I think I'm hearing, and I want to make sure that I'm not misspeaking here, that there seems to be at least a general agreement that reaching out to providers and asking them a list of questions with regards to numerous, not just the complaint, but probably a lot of the matters that we see here is a great way to obtain some data for us to review. So it seems to me that one of the tasks we need to get on then is preparing a list of questions for the providers. Kathy? Okay. I'm sorry. Martin Silva Valen says, I agree with Rebecca. Going into the cases is a must to answer a review question. Okay, and that starting with providers is a good start. Kathy?
Hi. Scott, I'm going to object because I don't think the providers will do it. When we went to the providers, IBM and Deloitte, we asked them how they did the process. what they accept into the proceeding. It's kind of like asking a judge what the content was of the briefs before him. And in the provider's case, they don't, the forum doesn't, you know, that's not their job to actually read and ascertain these things and see what the problems are. Their job is to administer. And so we'll be looking at them later for administration. These cases all have the names of the complainant or their attorney or the registrant and their attorney. Aren't that many cases, and I think we do need to go out after some of these. Let me list some of the other problems. You know, some of us went out and did some research on this ahead of time that we're hearing about complaints. And I don't think we're going to get the answers from the providers, but we can certainly get the answers from people who participate in them. One is the SMD file and how accessible it is. We're seeing problems opening it. Another is the online filing, which apparently doesn't allow text formatting or even simple paragraph breaks. So that's, you know, we should find that out. Apparently just submitting things is very, very burdensome. The complaints, how often are the complaints about common words versus kind of arbitrary marks? Again, a question I got from somebody, actually from John Berryhill, that there are, you know, that there is an issue. So how often are the complaints common words? Something we can very easily check. The proof of use, especially when you're dealing with a design or figurative mark, not something to ask the providers. This is something to ask the attorneys on both sides or the representatives on both sides. So I want to object. I don't think the providers provide the process. We've got to actually talk with, you know, real people, attorneys, registrants, complainants, about the substance. Thanks.
Okay. I'm turning to Susan Payne.
Susan, this is Terry. We're unable to hear you at this time. I see where you've disconnected. Oh, please check your mute button on the telephone.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes, but you are low in volume.
Sorry about that. I actually lost audio from you, so I didn't hear you calling on me. I think it's a bit difficult. I mean, Kathy raised a lot of issues there. She ranged around quite a lot, and I think it might be easier to take them in turn. But I think the point I was trying to make was that, you know, there's been a suggestion raised that there's some difficulty in accessing SMD files, and it seems to me, you know, it was being suggested that panelists were unable to do so, and therefore it seems to me, you know, an entirely appropriate question to be putting to the service providers, the DRS service providers. I haven't completely ruled out looking at cases in every single circumstance, and there seems to be a suggestion that I'm trying to do that. I was just saying, I think that at this stage we have a number of questions that it may well be the panelists and the service providers who appoint the panelists can answer for us. And before we start going elsewhere and talking to hundreds of people, which let's face it, we have no budget to do, we should be speaking to the people who are administering this process first.
Thank you, Susan. This is Jay Scott, and I'm at this point I'm speaking in my personal capacity. I think where I'm getting a little bit confused is every time I hear Kathy come up, I feel like she's interjecting new and additional things we need to look into rather than asking the question of looking at what we agreed to look into, what's the best place to get data to answer those questions. I see that she says there are additional issues, additional problems, additional things we need to look into, but it's not answering the question that I put to the group, which when you look at the things we've agreed to, the standing to file, the grounds of the complaint, the administrative review, notice of the complaint, where do we go to get this data, and how do we go about collecting it? That's the question I'm trying to get responses from everyone. I heard from, I would say, of the people who spoke, then I would say that's been under 10, but it seemed to me from my ears that a majority of people thought that the providers were a good source to ask a set of questions to get to answers or to get to data that might inform us in answering these questions and looking into these issues. And now Kathy has objected to that and says that's not what we should do. So I just need direction from the group as a as more than just one or two people, but a direction from the group on how they think we should proceed to get data to deal with that. We're on A, and we've been here for 32 minutes, and we need to start moving through these so that we can then start collecting the data so we can start doing our work. Kathy.
Yeah. I think this is really our first review of the complaint. We haven't kind of dived into it. Certainly, you know, proof of use falls underground for complaint. And if there, you know, and so how do we find out whether the grounds for complaint are sufficient for both sides? And that's not a provider question. So, you know, we've used lots of different techniques in the past, including opening up a questionnaire. And since it's, you know, probably a limited pool of attorneys, and I think we're going to get lots more questions for them as we go through this, attorneys or representatives on both sides, there may be, you know, on both sides of a URS proceeding, we may have a fairly limited pool of people that will be answering questions if we put them out there. Thanks. But again, a lot of what I was raising goes to grounds for complaints and also an issue that hadn't been raised, which is just ease of filing these things. Thanks.
Thanks, Kathy. Rebecca?
I'm so sorry. That was accidental.
Oh, okay. Phil Corwin.
Yeah, thanks, Jay Scott. Phil, for the record, you know, looking at this first question where we're looking at standing and grounds for filing and limited time period, the question there, you know, regardless how we get the data, and I think the data is, you know, our complainants providing grounds for filing in accord with the policy. But the policy question here, I got to say, I think is not relevant. The policy question next to the criteria we're considering for available data is, should the first element be modified to include names that are abusively registered, but they may not be confusingly similar or identical? Well, to me, this is a policy issue. It's a policy call regardless of the data, and my off-the-top-of-my-head policy response would be no. The URS is a subset of the UDRP, and if we're going to consider going beyond domain names that are identical or confusingly similar to a trademark, that's a mega question that should be reserved for UDRP review. It's not something we should be monkeying around with in something that's designed to be a fast subset of UDRP complaint for clearly abusive registrations. And if we're not dealing with a domain name that's identical or confusingly similar, I don't see how it could possibly be a black and white case that would fall within the URS. So I did want to comment on the charter question here, which should inform our search for relevant data. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. I do want to read into the record a comment from Renee Fossen from the forum. And Renee placed in the comment, why not have the providers do a high-level overview like Berryhill and Eisenberg did first? Formulate questions to providers next, then providers provide answers. And I see that Susan Payne has said she thought that sounded like a good idea with a plus one for Renee. So I throw that out to the group just in case people aren't on or paying attention to chat. And then I'll go to Zach and then John.
Thank you. Zach Muskwich. Yeah, I'm glad you repeated Renee's point there for the group. And from Renee's point, it seems that we can ask the providers questions and they could provide answers, they could provide the overview, and that might very well answer a bunch of questions we have. But It may not necessarily, excuse me, and so there, why couldn't there be a follow-up discussion on that when we say, okay, these are the answers we have. Are there any other questions that haven't been answered or follow from these answers? And I'm just thinking, just for example, you know, the policy requires a word mark. Have decisions, have panels consider design marks as well? And so why, you know, that's something that the provider probably can't answer, and we'd have to take a look at the decisions themselves. But I don't see any reason why we can't start with questions to the providers and see where that gets us.
Thank you, Zach. John?
Thanks, Jay Scott. John McLoyne for the record. So I think one of the reasons why we're having a hard time coming up with providing you and this group, this working group, guidance on what can be studied to answer, for instance, the first question standing to file, is that it's so high level. And this may be, I like the idea of having the providers come in and provide some of their take on these topics. And this may be a good example of a what kind of came out of the intersessional, where we could then take that knowledge and have a smaller group look at whether there is any data to analyze relating to standing to file. So at a high level, it's hard to, I think, come up with any suggestions on this call. But if we hear some of the problems, talk it through, and then work in a small group, we might be able to come up with some data points and areas to examine. Thanks.
Thanks, John. Any thoughts or comments in regards to John's proposal and Renee's initial proposal? I mean, because if you remember what the methodology was, we were going to look at each of these big topics and ask the five questions, right? Has it been used? Why or why not? What is the original purpose? Is it being fulfilled? Bearing in mind the original purpose, have there been any unintended consequences? I think that's where perhaps the point that Zach raised about if design marks are being considered and they're specifically prohibited from being considered because they're not enunciated in the policy, that would be an unintended consequence. I think also if Kathy's points about the difficulty to file, this is supposed to be cheap, easy, and fast. If it's difficult to file a response, then that doesn't seem like that's fulfilling its original purpose. If there are elements of proof that are not working correctly, then that is something we need to know. I did notice that Kathy mentioned in her comment that she thought that there were probably a small group of group of practitioners that we could probably put some questions to, and consider, you know, their responses to those questions. But I didn't hear anyone pick up on that or see if anyone else thought perhaps that was something worth pursuing as another group, or is the whole idea that we start with the providers, we see what information we can get from them, we decide if there are any additional questions, we decide then if there are still things that need to be considered, and then what groups we would go to. So far, the only things I've heard of data that we can glean, I've heard three sort of buckets of information. One is from the cases themselves, one is from the providers, and then Kathy also made the point of practitioners who often litigate in the URS and deal with the URS. So are there any other ideas for where we might find, you know, information with regards to not just the complaint, but if you look down throughout this list of high-level topics, the response, standard of proof, the defenses, the remedies, if there are other groups other than those groups that you think could assist us in identifying data that we could consider in an analysis on how to consider these particular topics. Zach.
Yes, thank you, Zach Muskovich. Yeah, just from reading the comments, and because we're trying to work through questions about where to get the data, I do see that quite a few people appear to do everything possible to avoid looking at the decisions and second-guessing panelists. And, you know, I can appreciate that. But I do want to point out that, you know, looking at these cases is quite easy and also presents some issues that are of utmost concern to trademark owners as well as to registrants. I've successfully used the URS as a complainant lawyer in a clear and convincing case where the respondent registrant had created a phishing site using my client's logo, his mark in a new GTLD, and was getting my client's customers' credit card data and other information. We were able to easily pass the clear and convincing test. But when I look at some, I looked at 58 cases where there was a denial of the complaint, and there were problematic cases in there that may very well have demonstrated that the test under the URS isn't being properly interpreted by panelists against complainants. Just for an example, there was Genzyme.xyz, Genzyme.online, decided by two different panelists. Genzyme is like a multi-billion dollar pharmaceutical company. In both cases, there was no use of the domain name at all. It was passive holding. And in one case, the panelist transferred one panelist transferred the domain, and the other he didn't, on the exact same facts, and this was apparent from a 5-minute read of these two cases. And so that shows me that resistance to actually looking at the cases by parties who are primarily interested in trademark rights may be a mistaken approach. I also saw a case, Netflix.news, where the panelist refused to suspend the domain name based on the respondent saying he intended to do a personal site about Netflix. And so the question becomes, you know, are the tests being properly interpreted? And this is an issue for trademark attorneys and people concerned about trademarks rights as well. On the corollary, I saw bcg.000. And there was no active use of a website, no use at all. And the panelists transferred or suspended the domain name purely on the basis that it corresponded to a trademark of the Boston Consulting Group, when there's like a couple hundred BCGs all over the world that have registered trademarks. So my point is that looking at the actual cases, which isn't that time consuming, considering there's only some 800 some of them, is of immense benefit when we're judging whether the policy is working or could be improved and what the problems are with it. So if anyone is compelled by those examples that I gave, there's probably more of them out there. And it's not that they're helpful for trademarks or registrant sites, and it's not mutually exclusive. But these things can be looked at and should be looked at. And so if there's any willingness to look at cases, we might as well look at them all throughout these different headings. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Zach. Susan?
Yeah, thank you. I put my hand up when Zach was talking, and that's really interesting, Zach. I don't think any of us are arguing or arguing the value of looking at the cases because we're trying to protect what we are perceiving as being trademark interests. I think we probably all could imagine that there are cases which have been wrongly decided, you know, in a registrant's favor as well as in a trademark owner's favor. There may well be. The fact is that in order to review these cases, all we have is the decision. We don't have all of the underlying facts and information that the panelists looked at. And so,
you know, you yourself, when you were presenting this to us just now, we're making all sorts of assumptions based on, you know, what you think you can see from the decision. And it's not our job to be basically running a second-line appeal, if you like, and identifying that some cases have been wrongly decided. That, in fact, doesn't help us in an establishment of whether the policy is working or not. What that establishes is potentially that there might have been some problems with some cases. There may be some panelists who've been deciding things wrongly. There might even be, you know, a question that about whether ICANN and its compliance department is exercising adequate control. But it's not about whether the policy is adequate and is working. And this is outside of our scope. And we'll just be guessing because we are basing our guesswork on just the decision.
If I can just respond to that, I appreciate what you're saying, Susan. I take your point. I would tend to disagree in a couple respectful respects. The first is that, you know, for a UDRP proceeding, it's quite clear that to make a comprehensive review of a decision, it would certainly be helpful to have the pleading. But even with UDRP proceedings, it's possible to come to some kind of judgment about the case. URSs are even simpler because you really only need a couple basic facts. Was there an active website? What was the proof of use required? Was there a response filed? Was there an explanation filed? Did the panelists properly state the test? And did the panelists interpret the test properly? Now, I couldn't care less whether one decision or a handful or a couple dozen were wrongfully decided in my subjective view. And so I take the point that we don't need to decide whether the panelist was correct or not, but certainly we are able to determine whether there was whether the test is being employed or whether the test should be reframed. For example, if we have panelists running off in all different directions with an unclear test of clear and convincing, where the some an active website is required and some isn't, that's something that we could fix in the URS as part of this review. So I'm not suggesting we make a wholesale review of see which panelists got it right, which got it wrong, but we can certainly identify if there is a theme that runs through at least a significant portion of decisions that are resulting in outcomes that are inconsistent, not envisioned, not protecting registrants or not protecting trademark owners the way the policy was intended. Thank you.
Thank you, Zach. Kathy?
Thank you. This is Kathy, and Zach Zachary raised some really good points. I wanted to address your question of what to do. So I went back to Renee's comment about why not have the providers do a high-level overview like Barry helps. It makes sense, but I don't think it gets us all the way. So I would recommend we do it in parallel. We've got specific questions. And as you noted, a manageable group of practitioners. I would do it in parallel. We've got time issues and time constraints. Let's hear from the providers, but some of the evaluation and also some of the commentary, isn't a provider issue. It's not a procedural issue. These are legitimate substantive issues. And I do disagree with Susan. Is the policy adequate? I do think we're a review team. That's one of our questions. Is did we get it right? So this is new. This doesn't have the 20-year tenure of the UDRP. The URF was new for clearly abusive slam dunk cases. And is it serving that purpose? That's a key question. And by asking both the providers and the practitioners, we'll get a much better idea. Thank you.
Thank you. Cynthia.
Hi, thank you. This is Cynthia King. So I'm reading through all of the comments in the chat and listening, and I am again very concerned that we are headed way off mission here and that we're getting very far in the weeds. So let's just say that we do review every single URS case, and we're looking at it to find out whether or not standards were applied appropriately. Already in our mailings and in the chats and the meetings that we've had, reasonable people in this group are disagreeing. So what will happen? What will happen when we review all of these cases and then there are people who disagree about what any particular, you know, these cases mean? Are we going to sit down and discuss every case and litigate every case in our group to decide whether or not that is suitable for us to make a decision for some kind of a policy that would prevent this particular instance? We are getting way, way far down into the weeds, and I don't think that everyone is taking into consideration what is going to happen once we hit the UDRP portion of our purview, because we cannot replicate this level of intense concentration on every case with the UDRP. We need to have a high-level discussion about what's going on. And for those folks who want to get down into the cases and determine whether or not they see problems, good luck. Let's go for it. Let's do it. And for Rebecca, if she wants to pull up some standardized data points that we can look at to better inform us, that seems wonderful. But we cannot get to the point where we are litigating all of these cases here in this group to determine what standard was used which where, and then maybe at some point talk about how to fix that. We have limited time. We have limited budget. We're already far behind what the GNSO wants for us to do. We really need to move forward. We've been on this call for nearly an hour, and I'm not sure that we've decided anything. Have we? We really need to proceed. That's my opinion. Thank you.
Thanks, Cynthia. I think, Zach, I see your hand, and then I see Jason's hand.
Yes, just a short comment. Thanks very much, Zach Muskovich. My question to the group is, do you know whether clear and convincing requires an active website or not? Because complainants' attorneys will certainly want to know that before they waste their clients' money and use the URS system where there's no active website. And respondents will want to know the answer to the same question. And so there needs to be some clarity on that issue because, as Kathy pointed out, that was the overriding framework for clear-cut cases, slam-dunk cases. And so we don't know whether these are slam-dunk cases because they're being decided both ways. Passive holding is being interpreted entirely differently. Maybe we could avoid that whole quagmire and problem by changing the policy, rewording it, adding interpretive guidance, or rethinking it. And so my point is that you can't even know that there's a problem without looking at the cases. And I'm not talking about which way the case was decided. I'm talking about a bigger question of whether there's a clear direction within the policy about how cases are supposed to be decided. Thank you.
Thank you, Zach. Jason?
Yes. Hi. I think Zach covered much of it. I mean, not to belabor the point, but, you know, our position is not to, let's be clear, no one wants to re-litigate 800 cases. We certainly don't want that. We're not advocating for that. But to the extent we want to fix or examine a system that may need fixing or improvement, it behooves us to have those data points. And to the extent that we are looking at if there is a discussion about bringing URS to legacy TLDs in the future, it would be important to have this analysis at our fingertips, as well as once you begin to move to legacy TLDs, you are now in danger of suspending more likely active websites, things that could be abused in a way that neither the trademark bar nor others would want.
Thank you. I think John McElwain is next.
Thanks, John McElwain, for the record. So I'd like to kind of maybe try to focus people back to some solutions. I mean, Jay Scott, Rebecca, and I have all suggested that we have some providers provide some information, some analysis, and then we set up a small group. I think that the issue of whether we need to do a review of cases or a sampling review of cases is a little premature until we look at what data points we need to try to get to establish some of these issues, such as standing to file, grounds for filing, et cetera. I don't think we all have a very good grasp on what we could study to look at these different issues. And when we have that, then I think we'd have a much more informed discussion on how to get that data. So I would kind of table all the current discussion and talk about a path forward to collect data. As we know, the GNSO Council said, you know, our mission is to make, you know, informed data-driven decisions, not to do subjective reviews of cases, not that anybody's asking for that right now, but that if we can really kind of focus in on what it is that these, not even questions, these statements are looking to get at, then we can have a better discussion on all this. Thanks.
Thanks, John. George?
Yeah. So I agree with Cynthia and with John's comments. I mean, I think that, we are going to get into endless, if we get into the review of the cases themselves, we're just going to have endless debates, and we're never going to move forward, and we'll be here for years discussing this. As to John's point, I agree heartily, is like, what is it that we're trying to, what are the issues that we're trying to look at and fix? Instead of saying, let's go look at cases and find a bunch of problems, and or maybe there are no problems, and then go from there. So in the first part, like, I could see, like, some major problems that exist. Like, there's only 800 and some URS cases. Should we be looking as to why are there only 800 cases filed after all these GTLDs were put out? As to Zach's comments, whether some cases are incorrectly decided or not based on the standard, there's an appeals process. We ought to be looking at, are people using the appeals process? Is there some reason they're not using the appeals process? And putting those data points together. But I agree that we need to have very clear sense of what it is that we're looking at, what are the problems that we're looking at that we know exist. Because certainly a lot of people have written a lot about the URS, so there's a lot of information out there already, and then pick the data points and what kind of review we need to do. And I think we might actually be able to move forward if we go down this path, as opposed to having this endless argument over, you know, should we look at cases, should we not look at cases?
Thanks, George.
Thanks, George.
Jeff Newman.
Thanks, Jeff Newman. I want to change a little direction here, and maybe this does relate to either looking or not looking at past cases. And there are some people on here that have been involved in this community for a very long time and involved with ERP for a very long time and URS. One of the concepts that was never adopted for either the UDRP or the URS was the whole concept that precedent matters. In fact, although panelists have the right to look at what was done before, there's no concept like you have in most, well, at least in the American court systems, where you look at what was decided before and use that to base your decision in the future. We could look at all these cases in the past and we can make inferences, but at the end of the day, until we set a policy that precedent matters, it doesn't really matter what we come up with from the past unless we want to document it firmly into the policy. So one of the issues we need to consider as a group is whether we want the concept of precedent to matter going forward. Thanks.
Thanks, Jeff. Before I move on to Steve and then Zach and then Barry, I wonder if, you know, if we have the providers do an overview, we ask them questions, we can agree on a list of maybe we can call that from some objective data, a list of practitioners that seem to be on both sides of the spectrum, well-versed in URS practice, and ask them a series of questions. If not doing those two things, won't identify what are perceived problems. And without having to look at necessarily look at cases, just look at what are perceived problems and then find solutions for those problems that the people who deal with it down in the trenches every day identify as problems, rather than us coming up and saying, well, we reviewed 25 of the 700 cases and we found this or we found this one case. I mean, if people who are dealing with it every day could come forward and tell us, well, in our opinion, here are the three top issues And then we can look at those and determine whether those are problems and try to find solutions to solve the unintended consequences of those problems. I just put that out there for the group. I want to go to Steve, then Zach, then Barry, then Jeff. Steve?
Thanks, Jay Scott. Steve Levy for the record. I think one of the problems that we have already identified, but which has been kind of overlooked in this discussion, is the lack of participation by respondents. Perhaps, as a lawyer, maybe I come from the advocacy and the adversarial culture where, you know, you file a case and somebody defends the case. I'm wondering if anybody is interested or has any information on why so few respondents actually defend their cases. And I don't think it's purely an issue of notice, although that's certainly worth exploring. I mean, I file a ton of these cases, and I've actually had email correspondence with registrants where I've attempted to negotiate a resolution before filing a complaint. If I'm unsuccessful, I then file the complaint, and then I get a default. So it's not that these folks aren't receiving notice of the dispute. It's not that they're, you know, unable to understand the communication. I wonder if just a lot of these problems that we're identifying here could be resolved or could be better understood if we understood better why so many registrants simply do not participate in this process and defend their cases and identify for themselves what they see as the problems or the merits of their case. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Zach?
Yes, thank you, Zach Moskovich. I had raised my hand before hearing what Steve Levy had to say, so I'm not responding directly to him, but that's an interesting question as well. And just as an aside, and this isn't one I intended to raise my hand about, it's pretty clear that so many of the respondents don't file because just the nature of the domain name itself. I mean, unless your nickname is Lufthansa, right? So it's, you know, looking at the nature of the domain names might give us some insight into that. And that's, I guess, the most cursory kind of case analysis, but it is a case analysis. But the point I want to respond to is about the precedential issue that some members of the group were raising in the chat. And I think there's a misunderstanding about what I had to say about precedent. In fact, I didn't mention precedent at all. And I realize, as someone who's practiced in this area since 1999, that cases go in both directions. And panels are human. They come to different conclusions. And so I have no interest in second-guessing a panel or relitigating a panel. But what I do have interest in, as someone who's representing both respondents and complainants, is knowing what kind of a case has a chance of succeeding. And so if the policy, the way it's worded, is unclear in terms of the direction that it gives panels, that leads to inconsistent decisions, and it doesn't necessarily need to be that way. If the 24-point bolded font, the beginning of the policy, to say that bad faith and use doesn't require an active website, well, we're going to have panels that more or less follow that guidance. But if we have a URS that says bad faith registration and use is required, but doesn't give any idea about what use constitutes potentially, then we're going to have decisions all over the place. And so isn't this something that we can look at to try to improve the URS to make it a more predictable and useful tool for practitioners, registrants, and trademark owners? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Zach. Barry?
Thank you, Jay Scott. I was hoping to save the intervention for when we were actually going through the document and the different sections around the aspects of what's being discussed here for the different elements within the URS procedures here. But I think it's time to go ahead and intervene in general. I think throughout our discussions for the last several weeks about, what type of URS review or the review of cases needs to be done. First and foremost, there has to be some sort. Again, this goes back to data-driven policymaking and evidence-based aspects in terms of any recommendations that this working group needs to put forward down the road, if there are any. That said, I think one of the things that staff has been pretty consistent about is, you know, this aspect of reviewing all cases versus buckets. And I'm sure some don't like the use of the term buckets, but I was hopeful that as we work through this document that there might be some examples by what we actually mean by buckets. And I don't have my chart that I put up in last week's call, but that's the very first start, again, of defining buckets. So for Section C, the response, as an example, there are 827 cases. You can subtract out 44 of them that are withdrawn, but ultimately we get to 263 cases that had some sort of response. And based on the charter questions that are listed here is, you know, would it be helpful information to know how many of those responded within the first 14 days or not? How many of those didn't respond within the 14 days but did ask for an extension up to 6 months? That is information that we can easily extract by reviewing the bucket of 263 cases to better understand anything about how the responses occurred in those particular cases. The second part is the response fee. I don't have any specific data sets about the cost or anything, but as per listed in row two there about cases that involve 15 or more disputed domain names. From the data we have, we can isolate those cases that had 15 or more domain names in them and take a look at it from the vantage point or the lens of should there be any changes to the response fee for cases of 15 or more. And then I'll stop after this, but the last part is kind of getting into the defenses section and the scope of defenses. And you know, in general, there's in Section 5.7 and 5.8 of the URS procedures is about the refuting of a claim of bad faith registration or non-bad faith use and some of the outcomes from that. So as an example of another bucket, again, looking back at my chart, and I believe Zach had mentioned this, there are 57 cases where the claim was denied. Of those, 26 of them actually had a response behind them. That's a very good bucket to review cases, again, not to second-guess the outcome of what the examiner's decision was, but more importantly, to at least look at the documentation in a way that to understand on which grounds did the complainant fail, or I put another way, what did the respondent refute successfully via 5.7 or 5.8 or some other aspect by which they prevailed? And again, that's just another example of where we can slice the data from the cases to get a better understanding. So we don't have to review all 827. And that's not to say that the largest bucket that exists out there where it was a suspension, a default suspension, that there's some statistically significant or some small percentage of those that perhaps need to be reviewed. But again, the whole point is, especially looking at this chart, is what section of the URS elements are we concerned about? Can we identify smaller buckets, for lack of a better word, that where there would be some sort of in-depth review of that individual case to extract the relevant data for that particular element? Thank you.
Thank you, Barry, very much. I appreciate that insight and that suggestion. I'm going to go to Zach, and then I have Maxim, Laurie, and George Kirikos. So, Zach? Oh, Zach must have been an old hand, so he has no longer has his hand up. Maxim?
Maxim, although for the record, actually, I think it would be useful to group some of those numbers by registrant, because, for example, in case of our TLDs, we had few cases where the person registered domains of well-known brands and actually didn't bother to answer to URS, because obviously it wasn't done in good faith, based on his previous actions in local CTLD, for example. So it would be interesting to understand how many registrants from those who didn't respond were actually the same registrant. In our case, it was four cases, one person, and different cases because parties decided to do it on themselves, for example, to file US cases. Thanks.
Lori?
Yes, hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Good, thank you. I have a few observations and a suggestion, and because I do feel like, again, we're kind of going onto the wide tracks instead of the narrow tracks in terms of the review. I want to make a comment about the WIPO overview. I saw that Mr. Levine had mentioned it in the chat, and we're all aware that WIPO has a very detailed, and they just released the most current version of an analysis of UDRP case law, and this is used to direct panelists, help panelists when they're stuck on hard cases or not sure what to do. And there's no such thing, to my knowledge, that exists to the URS. And at some point, perhaps the working group might, in fact, recommend that this is exactly what the URS needs. But I'd like to remind the group that when the UDRP was introduced almost 20 years ago, or about 20 years ago, the initial cases were decided sort of every which way. People weren't exactly sure. They would base their decisions on what they knew from their own national laws. They would base their decisions on individual interpretations of what free expression or criticism might look like and how it should be decided. And I think by way of example, a great analogy is the sucks, whatever sucks. Those cases in the past may have to be decided one way, but through an evolution of decisions, they're now typically decided another way. However, that was an organic growth based on a need and an evolution of an entirely new process. And I feel like that's where we are in the URS. So in terms of an overview of substance, it might be good to note in whatever report that we do that this type of evolution is at the beginning, and that we need to understand that it will continue along a certain line over a course of time, right? As opposed to trying to impose something now that I think most in the community would agree, at least on the complainant side, that this evolution of law over a course of time or evolution of decisions has really helped and moved the entire dispute resolution process forward in terms of the UDRP. I would offer we're just not there yet with the URS. There's a different standard of proof. There's a lower number of cases. It hasn't been around very long. So I do think that, again, and I have said this last week, and I'm sticking to this, that when we look at, if we decide we are going to look at these cases in any manner and that it would be useful to the community to do so, that we look from process perspective. Are rules being followed? Instructions being followed? Are the instructions clear? Are the cases being timely decided? In terms of substantive decisions, I agree. Let the academics figure that out. And let us, you know, as engaged members, look at these reports when they come along and inform us in our practice and perhaps even inform us in our review if the reports are done timely as independent data points. However, I take what Zach said to heart, and if there's a decision here to get that type of information, he just gave us an enormous amount of war stories. I don't understand. We have, as it said, over 100 people engaged in this work group. If everybody were to commit to submitting 10 examples of issues they run into in the URS, and we've compiled those examples, don't we have our data without getting more complicated than that? Thank you.
Thank you, Lori. I think those are some great points. I'm going to now go to George Kirikos, who I think his hand was next.
Thanks, George Kirikos, for the transcript. I just want to note that this is the first time I'm speaking today. Earlier, you referred to George, and it was George Nahedjevansky who was speaking for whoever was compiling this transcript. 2 points I want to make. First, just to respond to Lori, if the URS is still stabilizing in terms of its cases, that would be one reason to not adopt it for the UDRP. However, some of the people in this working group do want it to be imposed on legacy TLDs. And so without that review, I don't see how those people would ever be able to justify it being expanded to .com, .net, .org. If we take your statement that there's a high variability of the decisions, and so it's not stable enough for the for wider adoption. And the second point I wanted to make was with regards to this idea of reviewing subsets of the data, and the term used was buckets, in order to presumably lessen the work. I think we would create major statistical problems if that was done, because the sample is already small enough that it's at the edges of where you're going to get, 5% statistical significance with about 800 cases in terms of, variance and of actual observations. And so if you sample, if you don't sample, but if you review all sampling, you're actually looking at the entire population of cases. If you only sampled, say, 30 of them or 40 of them, you have the same kinds of problems that occurred in the INTA study, where there are just too few observations to get tight error margins in terms of the statistics. And so some of these buckets are going to be very, very small. And so you would have major questions about reliability of the data. But by reviewing the entire data set or population, we're actually not going to have those problems. And it's a sample that's small enough that you actually could review all the data, because if you, even in the worst case, assign 10 minutes per case, you're talking about, 800 divided by 6, which is just over 120, 130 hours of work, and divided over, multiple people, that's, a couple of weeks worth of work. And I thought 10 minutes per case is probably a long time, because a lot of these cases could be reviewed in a couple of minutes. And so we had posted previously the SurveyMonkey tools in terms of how many observations you would need if given a certain data set to have a certain number of statistical significance. And so if you had, say, 800 as the universe, you might need buckets of 300 or 400 in order to get tight error margins. And so if you did that, you'd have, all kinds of debates or whether there was statistical representativeness through the creation of the buckets. And so it's a way to avoid that problem entirely simply by reviewing them all. And the incremental extra effort isn't that great, in my opinion. Thank you.
Thank you, George. Now, Zach, I think I see your hand again.
Yes, thank you. So I'm wondering, there was some suggestions from the speakers and from in the chat that John made the point that not all data necessarily needs to be statistical. Is there any consensus amongst the group for following along the lines of something of Lori's suggestion of looking at cases to voluntarily or by members of this group to see if there's any issues that are spotted. Thank you.
Thank you, Zach. George, is your hand back up?
Yes, George Krikos again. If I could just expand on the prior point slightly.
Sure.
Yeah, so George Krikos again. If you think of the data set as equivalent to the size of the number of students in a typical high school, like a typical high school might have 800 people, some of these buckets would be down to, say, 30 people, which is the size of an individual classroom. And if you think of, say, some measurement of, you know, average height or some other metric, average weight, you could imagine that the results of sampling just a single classroom might be significantly different than what would be the case if you instead sampled the entire high school, whether it's IQ or athletic ability, you know, whatever the metric is, understudy. And so that could perhaps help people to visualize that there could be, you know, big statistical problems if these sample sizes were too small. Thank you.
Thanks very much, George. Again, this is J. Scott Evans for the record sharing the call. I put out to you is I don't understand why we just can't would it not be just as efficient or even more efficient to, you know, Barry's point was with regards, I believe, to some of the questions like defenses, you have to look at the cases where a response was filed. You can't, I mean, the 500 and something cases where there was a default, there is no defense. So you don't need to look at those cases, presumably. I mean, you would assume there's no defense since there was no response filed. So the only one there could possibly be a defense asserted would be in the 200 and something in which there was that. So, but I think one of the things I had suggested, and I haven't heard much comment on, is what about if we went to practitioners, we agree on a group of practitioners, and we ask them to identify issues and problems that they have, and then we work on fixing those rather than going through an entire look of all the cases and trying to identify those trends. Don't you think that there are people out there who already sort of have perspective on this that we could reach out to, that we could ask a series of questions for them to identify problems, and then we could work on solutions to correct those problems? I think that, you know, we start with that we can ask the same thing of the providers, have them give an overview, then we can ask them questions about where they've seen the highest sticking points, problems, concerns, where there have been issues, and then we can just do pick a group of practitioners that we can identify and ask them questions about where they have seen problems, trends, concerns, and we can reach out to this group and ask, you know, in your dealings with the URS, where have you seen concerns, problems? I think Zach came up with two today where he talked about where he had won cases. I mean, there is that kind of information out there that could identify problems that we then try to resolve. I look to Rebecca, and then I think it's George Kirkos again. Rebecca?
Thank you. So, J. Scott, I think that's a great idea. I think we should definitely do it. I think, though, that we also need to be able to collect data and look at other cases because there are significant selection problems. Self-selection is a big deal. That doesn't mean it's not really important qualitative data, but it means that we need to be able to do a reality check to see. And, you know, maybe it'll turn out that there'll be two things that there's a consensus on. That would be great. What I just want to emphasize is that we need to be able to ensure that it isn't just self-selection. Thank you.
Rebecca, can you clarify for me when you're talking about self-selection what exactly you're referring to? I apologize.
If we assume that the small group of repeat players who probably do know more about the URS than other people, even if we assume that their cases are representative of cases of, you know, the cases that different lawyers encounter, we don't know sort of the base against which they're bringing problems to our attention. So if there is a problem, and there may well be, with sort of incoherence on whether a website has to be in use, we don't necessarily know whether that's, you know, five cases that they bring to us or, in fact, you know, 100. You know, somewhere in between, whether it's in any sense representative of what's going on the ground as opposed to what the specific disputes that they see. So if we can compare, then we can see these are in some sense representative, or they're weird outliers that no system will be able to ever get rid of. Thank you.
Thank you. George?
Yeah, George Kriegel's here. Yes. Rebecca's making the same point that I wanted to make, namely that, and I've talked about it in the chat room, you know, we don't want to go back into having anecdotes of selected participants. We want to have a robust review of all the data. And what Rebecca was speaking about was 100% correct. You're not going to have representativeness of the data correctly if you're only relying on certain experts or who might be in dispute. With regards to only their observations. And so the only proper way to give weight to the observations is to actually look at all the data. Otherwise, you don't know whether the issue is actually overweighted or underweighted. We shouldn't be giving certain issues greater weight because they have a better public relations team, for lack of a better term. And so by actually looking at all the data, we'll be able to identify the issues that are perhaps lesser known. Thank you.
Thank you, George. Susan?
Yeah, thanks, J. Scott, Susan. I've just noticed the time, and we're really close to the end of this call, so I just thought, you know, it'd be really helpful if we could kind of wrap up where we've got to. Not that we've got tremendously far. I mean, I think we've had a really, you know, robust discussion about different ways of working, and that's been great. I'm personally a little disappointed that we didn't manage to get through some more of the kind of actual topics and highlight, you know, identify amongst ourselves data sources, but we ended up doing, you know, really most of this call arguing again about the extent to which we open up decisions in particular cases or the whole 800 cases. So I think it would be really nice if we could have a wrap up of what we have managed to agree on this call, and perhaps we either in the next call or maybe we do it by email in the run up to the next call, we could actually go through the topics and identify the data, you know, the sources of data, because not every single source of data is going to involve opening up a case. I think in many cases there is other information or you know, the information that the examples that Barry gave earlier when he came on about, you know, would it be helpful to know the number of cases where the response was filed after 14 days, the number of cases where the response was filed later and someone utilized that late responding, you know, extended response period. You know, that's all really useful and I think we do want staff to do that, but we haven't managed to cover that on this call, and I think that's a bit disappointing. I'm not in any way blaming you for that, but I think it would be really nice if as a group we could try to move the discussion forward rather than having the same discussion on every phone call.
All right, thank you, Susan. I mean, so far what I have gleaned, and I look to the group to let me know if they've gleaned the same thing, and you can use if you are on the Adobe Connect, you can use the green check mark to agree. The only agreement that I've heard so far is to bring the providers in, have them give us a high-level overview, and then we will prepare questions to ask them after that time. That's the only agreement. Now, I do agree with you that Barry's suggestion that the information that he can provide with regards to you know, how long, how many were filed in a certain time and all of those would be valuable information, but I haven't heard a groundswell of people saying that that's what they agree with. So, I mean, that's the agreement I've heard so far today. I've heard a lot of disagreement about what we do with case review, but I haven't. So I see Kathy's got her hand up, so I'll look to her to see if we get her perspective.
Thank you, and as we wrap up, I think today has been a useful discussion. I think there was a lot of support both kind of across stakeholder groups as well as in the chat for reaching out to that manageable group of practitioners and also reaching out to the people in the working group, many of whom are experts, to find out more about what's bothering them in the proceeding. So I think there was a lot of support on that. And I think there'll be questions that kind of route to the providers and questions that route to the practitioners, both in our working group and outside. So there was a lot of support for that. Thanks.
Okay. So that's another group of people that we could reach out to. So what I would suggest is perhaps, because I think this came out of the intersessional meeting, is perhaps we want to assign a small group to look at this and have, maybe a couple of different small groups working in tandem. One that works with identifying a group of practitioners and a list of questions that would go to the practitioners. One that perhaps looks at this document before us and makes suggestions about the data that we would consider with regards to what data sources we would go to answer the questions, and presents that to the group, similar to what we've done with the TMCH Sunrise and Sunrise Registrations TMCH Claims Notice. And then maybe a third group that would be impaneled to look at follow-up questions and things we would ask the providers after we got their presentation. That's sort of a way forward that I think, and if there were three different groups, they could use this time slot during the week perhaps for those groups and have the three groups meet consecutive, you know, at the same time, but just on different numbers, working on different aspects and then coming back together. That would be one possible work plan, so that we're moving forward with several different things at the same time, hoping that we can, you know, not delay by taking them consecutively, but doing them, at the same time. So does that sound like a plan, Kathy? Kathy's hand is down. Lori Schulman.
Yes, Jay Scott, I would strongly support that plan. I think working in parallel will save a lot of time. Maybe we do it like we do 3 weeks of a group working in parallel, and then the fourth week, everybody comes back together.
Okay. I think that's what we should do. So I would think one of the first things we need to do is have a call for volunteers that would work on looking at these overview questions and coming up with suggestions for data that we would consider. Then we have another group that will work on call for volunteers for a group that will work on assembling a list of practitioners that we can reach out to ask a list of questions, not only assimilating that list, but putting together a list of questions. And when I say that, I would hope that not everyone on that list would be in this group. I have some great understanding that some people would be in this group, but I would hope we could get people outside the working group as members of the practitioners group. and ask them questions. And then I think we need to set up a call with the providers, and we need to present to us, and then we need to have a call for volunteers for people who will take on the task of following up with the providers and providing a list of questions on issues we may have identified with the providers. That doesn't necessarily need to take place in tandem since we need to set up that call, and really couldn't happen until after that call, unless there is feeling that perhaps that group should get together and come up with some preliminary questions that they would like to see answered by the providers, and they put that together. And I see there's a question, what will the main group be doing while these sub-teams work? My suggestion was that the main group would not do anything, that each of these sub-teams would work. They would work in parallel with one another during the same time. Lori made the suggestion, George, that we do this for 3 weeks, and we circle back to the main group with everyone's output. So does that seem like a plan that we can get behind? George.
George Krikos. Well, not to want to be doing extra work, but it seems that it would be a very long delay if we just suspended the work of the main group. Like, isn't there anything else that we could be working on, like some of the TMCH stuff or some of the other stuff, while those sub-teams work on that? Because in terms of productivity, it kind of brings the momentum of the group to a halt. Thanks.
Susan Payne.
Yeah, I completely disagree that it brings the momentum of the group to a halt. I mean, we may not have, you know, a plenary call for every single person to talk about every single topic, but a selection of people from this working group will be progressing three different things, and will probably actually make more progress than during the whole of this call. I don't think that the only way of working is for all, you know, however many of us want to come on the call every week, to just come on a call and argue rather than progressing stuff. So I completely disagree with George that puts our timeline back. I think it actually is a really practical way of progressing things.
Yeah, and I think Kathy has made a point that would be three groups working in parallel, approximately 12 people per group. I'm fine with that. So I think Martin has given me a green. If I could let people know, if people could let me know if that's something that they are comfortable with, I think that's a way to go. So the first thing we're going to do is call for volunteers for these three groups. And then for the next 3 weeks, these groups will meet at this time slot and handle their, thing. And Kathy and Phil and I can rotate, either rotate, or we can be assigned to one particular group to be an ex officio member of that group. But if we could do that, I think that would be a great help. And it sort of falls in line with what I understand came out of the intersessional, is that using smaller groups to deep dive into things that then is presented back to the larger group seems to be something that's being encouraged by the GNSO as a more efficient process for working. And I'd like to be able to do that. I see that what I'm seeing here when I see anything is I see people agreeing that this is the way we should go. So that is the work plan that I think we have come to for this. And I think Phil makes a great point. Maybe we come back, we'll bring it back together in San Juan when we're all together in San Juan. So, because the week before San Juan, which is, we don't have a call. So that's what I suggest we do. I think it's a way to move things forward. I think it's a way to get people focused on certain things. And we can then bring it back. And, of course, everything that would be decided in the subgroup would come back to the group, and then it would be adopted as a group as a way forward, or adjusted if there were some concerns or anything like that. Your voice will not be ignored just because you're not in a working a sub-team working group. You will get a chance to weigh in on the output of any sub-team. I see Julie Headland has her hand up. We are now 11 minutes over, so I'm going to let her let us know when our next call is as well, and then we're going to draw this call to a conclusion.
Thanks, Jay Scott. And so just confirming the action items that staff will take, we're going to do the call for volunteers for three groups. The three groups are going to meet at this time for the next 2 weeks. My understanding is there will not be a meeting the week before ICANN 61 because that is the 7th and people are likely to be traveling. And we'll get the call for volunteers out. I think tomorrow we should be able to. Is that correct?
That is correct. Unless I see someone raise an objection, I see both of the co-chairs are typing, but it's not coming through for me, so maybe they're talking to one another, but okay.
I see that Kathy is saying in this case there might be a meeting the week before ICANN meeting. My understanding is there is not because I do know that people will be traveling on the 7th, so it's quite likely, and including staff will be traveling, I can say that as well. So I don't think we're going to be able to manage a meeting on the 7th.
Okay. All right.
Okay. All right. Then thank you all, and thank you very much, Jay Scott, for chairing. Sorry, everybody, that we went over, and you will soon see a call for volunteers from us. Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. I appreciate everyone's time this evening, this morning, this afternoon.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you. Operator Harvey, if you could please stop all recordings. To everyone else, please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.